From NPR and WBUR, I'm Susan Davis.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Puerto Rico is bracing again. Tropical storm Dorian is on a path toward Puerto Rico and the Eastern Dominican Republic, possibly a hurricane by tomorrow. There's a state of emergency in effect in Puerto Rico, which is still recovering from Maria, the Category 4 hurricane that devastated that island in 2017. NPR's Adrian Florido is in San Juan. And Adrian, we presume there's a run on grocery stores and bottled water.
I was actually just in the grocery store about 2 hours ago, and the water shelves were completely empty. So people are beginning to take preparations. I mean, there's not like a wide, scale sort of hysteria or anything, because this storm isn't expected to be nearly as big as Hurricane Maria. But people are nervous, because the memories of Hurricane Maria are still very, very fresh in people's minds and in people's psyches.
Yeah.
So, really just the talk of any possibly strong weather event here is often enough to trigger a sort of PTSD for a lot of people.
Sure.
And there is amount of that going on.
Well, sure. And next month is the anniversary of Maria. And you remind us that, there's still 30,000 people living with blue tarps on their roofs. I mean, this is a more fragile Puerto Rico than it was in 2017.
It is, because the hurricane recovery has been pretty slow. There are still, like you said, an estimated 30,000 homes across the island that have those infamous blue tarps, and that is one big concern. Another big concern is the power grid, which has been in bad shape for many, many years here in Puerto Rico, but is still especially fragile after Hurricane Maria because the rebuilding happened very quickly after the storm in an effort to just get the power back on for people. When I say the rebuilding happened quickly, I mean that it took a long time, but they were sort of making patchwork repairs and weren't really strengthening it. So the grid is still very fragile and is in the process of being strengthened, but is nowhere near complete. And so strong winds or heavy rainfall could bring a lot of trouble.
Yeah, well, your governor there, Wanda Vasquez, is telling people to be calm. And also, I think, obviously trying to reassure them, she provided a list of all the equipment that agencies have bought since Maria. What kinds of things, and is it making people feel safer?
Yeah, well, so last night, Wanda Vasquez, she held this lengthy press conference in which she spent like a whole half hour essentially just reading a list, like you said, of all the things that Puerto Rico's government has done to prepare, according to her. So she talked about how the electric utility company has more than 20,000 utility poles and 7,000 transformers and 120,000 light bulbs in storage, how it's signed agreements with 33 U.S. companies that would allow these companies to quickly get to Puerto Rico to start restoring power should that be necessary. She said the government has hundreds of electric generators ready to go, that hospitals have made sure that their generators are full of gasoline, that radio communication systems have been installed across the island. And like I said, she went on for half an hour. These are all things that were not in place before Hurricane Maria. So she is trying to reassure people that the government is ready here. That said, you find a lot of people here who doubt whether it really is, in part because Puerto Rico has not really had a strong weather event to test how fragile things really are since Hurricane Maria.
Well, we just spoke with you last month after then Governor Ricardo Rossello resigned after those protests. And here we have new Governor Vasquez just sworn in earlier this month. A test of the island maybe, but a test for her as well.
Oh, it's absolutely a test for her because, Governor Vasquez takes a lot of pride in saying that she is not a politician, that she took office earlier this month because the governor resigned and not because she wanted to be governor. So she has tried to use that to her advantage in terms of the politics of Puerto Rico, but she also is not necessarily the savviest figure because she is not a politician. And you could tell that yesterday at this press conference when she essentially spent a half hour in front of cameras that were broadcasting live looking at a piece of paper reading this long list, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, she was flanked by the heads of the island's emergency management agency, its public security director. She is trying to reassure people. But like you said, this is absolutely a test and people are watching to see, okay, how capable are you given that you've only been in office about 3 weeks?
Yep. That's NPR's Adrian Florido in San Juan, Puerto Rico. As now Tropical Storm Dorian bears down on the island, could be a hurricane by tomorrow. Adrian, thank you so much for being there to cover it. Thank you.
No, thanks, Robin.
Tomorrow is the deadline for candidates to qualify for the next Democratic presidential debate on September 12th. So far, 10 candidates have met the qualifying standards, which are registering at least 2% in four qualifying polls and collecting donations from at least 130,000 individuals. If no one else qualifies, there will be just one debate night this time around. Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He joins us now. Julian, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So we're still a few months away from the first votes being cast, but it looks like the Democratic field is already narrowing itself a bit.
It's narrowing, but it's still very fluid and competitive. You have a clear front runner. Some of the bottom candidates are dropping off. But then in that second slash first tier, Bernie Sanders, Senator Warren, Harris and others, you have people who have a viable path to the nomination. So this will be about New Hampshire and Iowa and Super Tuesday to determine where things stand.
The latest poll out this week from Monmouth University essentially shows a three-way tie among Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, all at about 20% among Democratic voters. Do these results reflect the debate Democratic voters are having about electability, in that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are very different kinds of candidates, and where the Democratic Party is on who they think can beat Donald Trump?
Yeah, I think one poll always needs to be treated with some skepticism. But
although they are the front runners, yeah.
Yeah, and it also reflects what we've seen certainly with Senator Warren. Her trajectory has been upward. I think electability is a vague and ambiguous concept. So if you make that the centerpiece of the Democratic nomination, which it is at this point, it's going to open the door to many different kind of candidates explaining what that might be. And so I think that's part of what makes things difficult for Biden to totally secure his status going into Iowa.
I want to take a moment and look back and reflect with you about something that was happening in Chicago at the Democratic Convention 51 years ago this week. Here's some sound from the news coverage back then.
Police formed into a wedge, waded in, and the battle was on.
1968 police anti-war protesters, full-scale riot all over television. The Democrats then were terribly divided. I think we hear so much about divisions today, but when I hear that and look back, I think, doesn't seem so bad today.
No, the divisions within the Democratic Party were much greater back in 1968. You had the normal division between Southern conservatives and Northern liberals, but then the war in Vietnam, as well as race relations, had opened up huge fissures within the Democratic Party. And in the 1968 convention, those were on television. They were front and center for everyone to see. And so there were real divisions over what to do in Vietnam, as opposed to what are often more strategic divisions today about how to achieve common goals.
What does history tell us about incumbent presidents running for re-election? And what's your assessment of where President Trump is sitting right now in terms of those historical parallels?
Well, the odds for incumbents, especially when the economy is strong, are very good. They often go on to be reelected. There are some exceptions, such as Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush, both who had weak economies and who had divided political parties. So there is a way in which President Trump follows in that trajectory, especially if the economy goes southward. But Democrats should be wary. Incumbents have a lot of tools, especially when their party is united behind them.
One issue that does continue to divide Democrats is the question of impeachment. We've spoken with you before about this issue. There's a new story in Politico that says members of Congress who have spent weeks back at home over the August break are being grilled by constituents about the issue of impeachment at town halls this summer. The story says pro-impeachment sentiment might be hard for Democrats to ignore. Do you think the mood has shifted on impeachment?
Well, certainly support among Democrats within the House has expanded in terms of those who support impeachment proceedings. We've seen the numbers go up, but the divisions are there. I think what makes it hard for Speaker Pelosi and for those who are hesitant about moving forward is that they agree on the case, meaning they agree there's an impeachment case to be made. They're arguing pragmatically this isn't the time to do it, while supporters of the impeachment process have a moral fervor that will continue to keep them at the grassroots and to keep them out there on the campaign trail throughout the next few months. So it's going to be hard for Speaker Pelosi to contain this.
What about the argument, though, that she and others make that moving forward with impeachment, even if the politics are there, will ultimately end without a conviction? As long as Senate Republicans are in control, the idea that they would convict the president seems like a fantasy.
Well, she has to decide, does she want Democrats to go on record about what they think the president has been doing? And maybe that's a reason enough to move forward rather than just thinking about the conviction and force Republicans to take a stand. Do they support the president, what he's done, or don't they? So that's the counterargument to the speaker.
Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. As always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Government statistics say about 2.2 million adults are being held in American prisons. And for many, that means no contact with the outside world. Now a video project, Hidden Lives Illuminated, hopes to change that, at least for some. Inmates at the Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution in Chester make little films, which are then projected onto the exterior walls of another prison, Eastern State Penitentiary, now a museum, while members of the public sit outside and watch. Leading the project, Sean Kelly, Senior Vice President and Director of Interpretation at Eastern State Penitentiary, now the museum. Sean, you there?
I am, yes.
Sean, you had a great way of explaining this. You say prison walls, like the ones at Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, not only keep the prisoners in, but they keep the public out.
Oh, that's a saying you hear a lot in prisons. Well, Paul is here. One of the filmmakers is here with me. He can tell you better than I can. But I've heard many people over the years say that when they're incarcerated, they feel really cut off from the outside world. And we want to use our wall not to divide people and break families up, but to bring people together and as a canvas for people who are incarcerated to tell their stories directly to the public.
Well, let's bring in Paul. He's an inmate. We're going to call him Paul M. because prison officials have asked that we not use his full name or talk about why you are in prison, Paul. But we know that it's been decades.
Yes. Actually, one decade and a half of the second decade.
And how many years left?
Seven.
Yeah. So first, let's talk about what this project is. Sean, it involves animation, very short films, writing them and then making them themselves. Tell us more about what these films are.
We've brought in a team of animators and script writing coaches, and we've been supporting the incarcerated filmmakers here in making animated films about their lives or about issues that are close to them. Many of them wanted to write about their families. And then they've produced animated films that run about a minute and a half each, which doesn't sound like much, but a minute and a half is actually a good chunk of time. Mm. TV commercial is usually 30 seconds, so it's like three in a row. Mm. And in a piece like Paul's, you can really tell a full story with a beginning, a middle, and an end that can be very evocative.
Well, Paul M., we want to hear a little bit of your film. But first, tell me, when you heard about this, you know, hey, we're going to learn animation and make little films, what drew you?
Well, from the beginning, I've always liked films. And as far as the animation part, I wasn't sold that much on that part because I don't have any artistic skills, or at least I thought I didn't.
They argue that point, but right.
But the script writing part was actually something that I've always been interested in because I like movies and I like the scripts and I like stories. So that, you know, I was sold on that alone.
Yeah, we're gonna post your film at hereandnow.org. Listeners can see for themselves. But did you find out? Hey, I am an animator.
To a degree, yes, to a degree.
Well, let's listen to a clip and tell us a little bit about what this is about, and then we'll listen.
Okay, well, this film, it takes me back to 1986. I was about 7 years old, and my father used to come get me over the weekend, and, you know, we used to watch these three films. So one was Fright Night, The Neverending Story, and Flight of the Navigator. You know, my father was out on bail for a crime, and he ended up going to jail for about 6 years. So during my incarceration, maybe this past year, about November of last year, surfing through the television, I saw Flight of the Navigator.
And even though decades later, that sparked memories of watching the film with your father, memories you wanted to share with him. Let's listen to a little of Paul M.'s Nostalgia. That's the name of the film. We see big hand-drawn numbers showing the year, then the silhouette of a young boy looking up at his father. Let's listen.
The year, 1986. Vivid impressions wash over me. Precious moments being with my father. Together, just the two of us, engrossed in cinematic genius, captured in three of our favorite movies, The Neverending Story, Fright Night, and The Flight of the Navigator. My eyes drinking the sight of a proud and composed father. Show me a hero, and I'll write you a tragedy. My father, out on bed.
At the end there, we see a sketch of your father. It seems quite good. Then hands gripping the bars on a jail cell. Again, we'll post it at herenow.org. But I'm wondering too, Paul, if this project also gave you a chance to somehow examine. I mean, you mentioned your father also had been in jail.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, I didn't realize it until making this film how much his incarceration affected me. And likewise, you know, I have children. Even though I may not see and they may not tell me, you know, at 41 years of age, you know, I've just now let my father know exactly how much his incarceration affected me. Mm. We just don't have that type of, you know, relationship where I talk to him and tell him things that happened 30, you know, plus years ago.
But this was unexpected. He didn't even remember the movie.
Right, right. Right, exactly.
Was that crushing?
In the beginning it was, but once he said that Fright Night stuck out more to him, I could understand because that was kind of like, you know, that was like a deep, deep movie, vampires and whatnot.
Well, so, Sean Kelly, we hear that this was more than just making a minute and a half animation. This is somebody, you know, having some self-examination. Sounds almost like a little bit of video therapy.
I mean, obviously the stories, when I hear stories like that, it you know, fills me with great pride for the project. But we didn't start this project in order to rehabilitate anybody. We're thinking about how to connect with people outside of prisons. And we're not saying that there shouldn't be consequences, but we are saying that we can't just forget about people behind prison walls. And so we could only tell that story so well without some help. We needed to have help from people who live behind walls. And so we're just a group of people trying to make something interesting for the public.
Well, it seems to have gone beyond that because it sounds as if a lot of the inmates do talk about family. One of them, Justine O.G., made a film, and the musical performance on the film is from his 15-year-old son, Justin. Here's a little bit of another film by Lamar L. Here we see beautiful hand drawings, white lines against a black background, a lion surrounded by playful cubs. It's called My Kids.
My children are very important to me, like Simba was to King Mufasa. My children are destined for greatness, but they cannot follow my path. I thought I was a king like Mufasa. But what kind of king lead their cubs into the darkness?
Paul M., I'm wondering if you talked to each other about this, because this seemed like a theme for you as well, you know, of your father was in prison, you have children, you're in prison, and it seems like Lamar L. is also thinking about, I don't want my children, my Simba, to follow me into this darkness.
Yeah, we did talk about it, and because he's on the same block that I live on. Mm-hmm. We were like real close-knit during the making of the films, and he put a lot of effort into that, because he truly loves his kids. If I'm not mistaken, we've been on visits numerous times, and the embrace that I see him connect with when he comes out there, it reminds me of the one time that I did see my father during his incarceration, and I always bring that up to him.
Did your children go and sit and watch this projected from a coffee shop onto the walls of the Eastern State Penitentiary, which again is now a museum? Did they go? Did they see it?
Yeah, actually, my son did. He'll be 15 in January, and he was about 2 months when I got incarcerated. So this was like something that he never knew. You know, he has some questions now, like, wow, Pop, you know, he went to prison before.
Yeah. So it sounds wonderful. We're going to link people. I know, Sean Kelly, it was an idea you got from the project from Illinois, Stories from the Inside Outside. This was a 2015 art installation produced by Illinois inmates projected outside the Cook County Jail. It sounds like it has tremendous benefits. But what do you say, both of you, to people who say, I'm sorry, if you're incarcerated, I don't know what you did, Paul M., but you did something bad? You should not have the privilege of learning how to make an animated film. I mean, you know, start with you, Paul, and then Sean. What do you say to people who say, that's a waste of my taxpayer dollars if it is that, or that's just not what prisoners should be able to do. I can't even learn how to do that.
Our superintendent in here has a phrase to people that think that way, and I'll quote her because I like the phrase. Everyone in here is in here for making a mistake, and everyone in here have been judged and sentenced due to that mistake. So, as she says, would anybody like to be judged on their worst day? And having said that, there are people in here who just had one bad day and it turned into a horrible day. And they're trying to say, hey, you know, it was just one of those days. Regardless, they actually are good people and are putting forth efforts to show people that and to tell others not to make the same exact mistakes that they made. Sean?
I would add that it's not taxpayer dollars. It's our generous funders, the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage, who paid for the project. That said, it's not for everybody. If someone feels that way, maybe they should catch our next project. Mm. But this project is about these voices from behind these walls. And I maintain that they're powerful stories that we could all learn from.
The voices are heard in the project Hidden Lives Illuminated, films, animated films made by inmates and then projected on the wall of the Eastern State Penitentiary, which is now a museum in Pennsylvania. That's Sean Kelly, Senior Vice President, Director of Interpretation at the museum, and Paul M., an incarcerated inmate at the Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution at Chester. Paul, Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
School began last week in Mexico City. And with the school year comes a new government-issued school uniform policy. Students are allowed to wear skirts or pants, regardless of their gender. Rodrigo Cervantes of KJZZ reports.
Classes are over today in Mexico City, and students empty their classrooms. Among them is Gerardo Vilchis, a 13-year-old junior high student who tells me about the new uniform policy.
Van a permitir que los hombres vengan con falda y las mujeres con pantalón.
Boys will be able to wear skirts and girls' pants, explains Gerardo. And he thinks that's cool, as students will be able to express freely through their clothes.
También muchos seguramente lo traigan por juego, o no sé.
Gerardo says that the only problem he can think of is guys wearing skirts just to fool around. And would he wear one?
Pues no sé, la verdad. Sí, tal vez.
He says he is not sure about that, but maybe. Someone who also thinks the new rule is positive is Lourdes Rios. She's picking up her two teenage girls.
Está bien. Deben de ser de mente libre.
Rios says new generations need to free their minds.
Pero ¿por qué no dejarlos? O sea, ¿por qué no dejarlos?
Pero
o sea, ¿cuál es
no hay problema? No hay problema, pero pues como que no estamos.
And as we chat, another mom joins the conversation. She's Mari Carmen Tapia, who at first says it would be weird for boys to wear a skirt, but later adds that...
Digo, a lo mejor, ¿en dónde vemos eso en Escocia, no? Las faldas. Aquí somos mexicanos, ¿no?
Men in Scotland and in ancient cultures used to wear them, so why not?
Cuando estamos en nuestros días, ¿no? No es algo agradable traer...
And Tapia adds that pants would be great for teenage girls when they start their period, as skirts make them an easy target for bullies.
Que quitemos un poquito la venda de los ojos y veamos más allá, ¿no?
Both parents end up agreeing on the uniform policy. Rios says it's time to take off the bandage from our eyes as times change. But for Mexico's National Union of Parents, a century-old nonprofit, the new policy is problematic. Images of Jesus and Mary welcome visitors to the entrance of the temporary facility of the organization, which claims to be non-religious and non-partisan. Marco Tulio Mendoza is its spokesperson.
No resuelve, no aporta, y pues sí ideologiza.
Mendoza says they are against the policy, as it doesn't solve inequality among students and only plants the idea that gender is not determined by biology, but by society.
Lo que no queremos que ese tipo de cosas las decida el Estado.
Mendoza says the government should allow parents and not kids to decide what their kids should wear to school and focus instead on improving the public school's infrastructure and education level.
Ya quiero ver que un niño llegue con falda a la escuela, los problemas de bullying que tuviera.
The new rule is confusing, he adds, and says that boys wearing skirts will make them victims of bullying. But someone who thinks this is the right thing to do despite Mexican machismo is Paola Lona. She's a psychologist and co-owns a pre-K school in Mexico City.
this thing is not about the skirts or the pants. It's about having freedom of choice.
Lona says new generations need to learn to take ownership of their actions and their identities, and there is no age limit to do so.
Are we ready to choose a skirt or pants at age 8? Yeah, of course we are.
For Lona, the change might not be immediate, but she says it will bring results.
I didn't think in my wildest dream I would be talking about this. I just really hope it works.
For Here and Now, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
Democratic presidential candidates have until tomorrow to qualify for the September debate, a tough climb for the lower tier, including New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who joins us. Mayor de Blasio, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
So I tweeted out, what should I ask Mayor de Blasio? And many people said, why? Why are you running? You are billed as a progressive for Medicare for All, but so are Sanders and Warren. You're very proud of your mixed race family. But there are Democrats of color running. So make your case. Why Bill de Blasio?
Robin, it's about the need to change this country urgently. America right now is not working for working people. This is the central thing I talk about. And we have to do something very, very different. And what I bring is proof it can be done. We instituted the $15 minimum wage, paid sick days. We now are guaranteeing health care for anyone who doesn't have health insurance. We're giving them a health care card. They get a primary care doctor. They pay what they can. These are real life things that are making a huge difference for millions of people. I've been able to do them in a really tough environment, and that's why I'm running.
Let's take inequality. New York is experiencing a homelessness crisis. Homelessness has hit a record during your time in office. You also praised a big expansion of the city's rent control law. We spoke to a Stanford economist who says rent control actually makes housing affordability worse in the long run because landlords have less incentive to do upkeep. She said, if you want to subsidize housing, give people a direct subsidy, build more housing. We know you try to do more affordable housing. That's a lot of cities have been running into trouble with that. Yes, your intention was to make things more equal. But did it work?
Yeah, Robin, I appreciate all those points, but I'm going to give you some facts that I think will make you feel a little bit better, at least. So hundreds of thousands of folks already have been lifted out of poverty because of the things we've done to fight inequality, because of that $15 minimum wage, because of affordable housing programs. Let me tell you, rent regulation, rent control, it works. And I'm glad we strengthened the laws. We did a rent freeze for 2 years in New York City because we had those laws, and that helped immensely. We have finally gotten real progress in reducing our shelter population. So if you were to ask a lot of my colleagues in this presidential primary for their version of what they have done, some of them have had an opportunity to run something, but obviously not on this scale by and large. So I think that's why when voters are looking for proof of who someone is, what they're about, I got a lot to show here that I think could really, really help us change this country.
Well, and you had a chance to show it at the CNN town hall on Sunday night, but it was right out of the gate overshadowed by the story that has flared up in the last month and seems to have overtaken your campaign a bit. Let me just outline. This is, of course, the death of Eric Garner 5 years ago, his famous words, "I can't breathe," helped launch the Black Lives Matter movement. He was held in a prohibited chokehold by New York police officer Daniel Panaleo, who was fired by your police chief on the recommendation of a judge just this month, 5 years later. Now, you know, people asked you about this case and why did it take so long? And you talked about police reform, calling for more, and talking about what you've already done, de-escalation training, for instance. But you were heckled by an activist who was yelling out, "What about the four other officers who also piled on Garner during his arrest for selling loose cigarettes? Should those other officers face discipline?"
Well, Robin, I'll answer that, but I want to also first put the bigger question in perspective. Respectfully, we've changed the entire nature of policing in the nation's biggest city. All those things I talked about at the town hall meeting, I think they're a hell of a lot more important than whether a single heckler showed up. Literally teaching de-escalation training to every single police officer. Now, if you say, well, okay, what about what happened here? Why was there a delay? There was a delay because the United States Department of Justice told us not to act on our own disciplinary hearing. They told us they would take the lead. They failed to do so. But look, in the end, Robin, the biggest thing here is justice was served. And where was it served? Within the NYPD. And that shows progress and reform unto itself. This case now, there was one case in addition to Pantaleo, and that is the end of this whole process because all other statute of limitation issues have run, and this is the end of it. But what we have to do going forward is the much more crucial thing, just continue to deepen reform here and everywhere, and it can be done.
Well, also as a mayor, as Pete Buttigieg knows, you have to also have your police force on your side, and it one point, they turned their back on you. It was, during this controversy.
Well, Robin, let me just finish the question.
Should also the laws be changed? I mean, here are police asked to enforce a law about selling loose cigarettes.
So first, the reason I wanted to respond, when you said they turned their back, a few dozen officers did, and out of a force of 36,000. But yeah, no, we've changed. In fact, when I came into office, the previous approach, it was very aggressive policing. There was stop and frisk being used on a wide level. We ended stop and frisk the way it was being used.
But did you end it completely? Because I thought some people were critical that this is the windows theory that, if you check on things as little as a broken window or, a stop and frisk, it'll get rid of the even more serious crime. But do you feel that you have stopped that enough? Some of your critics would say no.
Stop and frisk as a strategy. There's very few stops now, and they're only done when there's a specific rationale, which is the only appropriate use of stop and frisk. It's night and day. It's over a 90% reduction, and it has fundamentally changed reality, the relationship between police and community.
Yeah. There was another moment, and it involved police as well, a very powerful emotional moment in the CNN town hall when you were asked about the recent spike in police suicides in New York. It's happening in other cities, too. It's terrible. And an officer asked, how can you improve mental health for the military when it's so obviously bad among the police force? You had some answers for that, and I want to hear from you. But you also explain why this is something that hits home to you, that your own father, a World War II veteran, so was mine, killed himself, took his life when you were just 18. This is not something you are unaware of.
No. And Robin, so you probably know from your own experience, I mean, the folks who come back from war come back carrying a lot. In my dad's case, it was PTSD. He had been in one of the worst battles in history on Okinawa and lost half a leg to a grenade. And the emotional toll, I saw it as a young child, it got worse each year. He would push away help, and then he was gone. And, he might have lived if he could just accept the help. And we've got today in America, we're losing folks who have served us because they still feel like there's some shame in asking for help. We all have to fix that. The government has to fix it with making mental health care just as accessible as physical health care. But we all have to speak up and say, if there's a mental health challenge, there is nothing wrong with it. Just come forward and let's get the help people need. It's there.
Mayor de Blasio, as I watched you speak so passionately about this and powerfully in the CNN town hall, I found myself thinking, what happened here? Because, as you well know, you had an upset win in New York. Your family, mixed race, a feeling, especially in the Obama era, of forward movement. And yet it feels like some air went out of that tire. And then we came across the New York Times article, how Bill de Blasio went from progressive hope to punching bag. And it talked about how you didn't seem to come across to New Yorkers as liking the city and that there was some sort of momentum that was lost. What do you think happened to that energy?
Well, I'm going to just tell you a different story that I think happens in truth.
Yes.
There's a difference between sort of the public discourse and then what people are actually living. I have young people come up to me all the time, young men of color, and say, thank you, I'm not stopped all the time by police. I have folks come up all the time and say, pre-K's changed my family's life. We never would have gotten early child education for our kid. We couldn't have afforded it. So that kind of... the dialogue among the folks who like to comment You know, that's one thing. But if you go to everyday working people in this city, I think you'll find something very, very different.
Yeah. I'm going to do the lightning round. One sentence. Why will New York Mayor Bill de Blasio be the one that will defeat Donald Trump, which is what Democrats want to hear? One sentence.
Because I'm speaking up for working people, and he lied to working people, and that's his Achilles heel.
That's New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, running for president. Mayor de Blasio, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Robin.
Brazil announced today that it's rejecting an offer of $20 million that the G7 countries have pledged to help fight the fires in the Amazon, suggesting instead that that aid might be better used to reforest Europe. Relations between Brazil and the West have been tense this week, with President Jair Bolsonaro blaming non-governmental organizations for setting the blazes, and the West blaming him for his loose environmental policies. But there's another group with a stake in this, and that's us, the consumers, who buy much of the beef and other products that the Amazon is being burned to provide, nearly $300 million worth in 2017 before a food safety ban went into effect, a ban President Trump has said he'd like to lift. So what's a conscious consumer supposed to do? Joining me now is Christian Poirier, director of Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that works to protect the Amazon and a critic of the Bolsonaro government. Christian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We spoke to a Brazilian scientist last week who implored consumers here to know their supply chains, in his words. But that's not actually very easy to do. Is there anything consumers can do to responsibly buy burger meat or other food products that could be coming from the Amazon?
Well, increasingly, we're seeing the U.S. is considering importing more beef from Brazil, which would be an absolute catastrophe. Donald Trump and Jair Bolsonaro are talking about a free trade agreement that could open the floodgates to the kind of destructive activity we're seeing today in terms of beef production, because beef is driving the vast majority of illegal deforestation and indeed driving the fires we're seeing today, because many of these fires were set by Brazilian cattle ranchers to expand their operations. One of the companies we identified in our report, JBS, is very active in the U.S. as well. In 2017, they had almost $30 billion in revenue in this country alone, and they own companies or have the majority ownership in companies like Pilgrim's Pride, which is a well-known brand that people buy and maybe not be aware or not aware that they're buying into a highly corrupt and destructive company. JBS has been involved in sprawling corruption scandals in Brazil and is already ensnared in a number of dirty business operations here in the United States. Meanwhile, we American consumers are consuming goods that go right back into the pockets of these bad actors in Brazil.
It does seem, though, that it is still pretty difficult for a consumer on a day-to-day basis to be able to make smart decisions about their lives that would, you know, align with their values.
Well, one thing we saw in the recent IPCC report is that we can limit our consumption of meat, because if we do that, we are going to get 20% closer to the solution that we need to keep our planet from only rising 1.5 degrees Celsius. In other words, to avoiding the worst of the climate crisis. So part of the solution here is changing our habits in some degree. And yes, it is difficult to know where our products come from. If possible, we can limit the purchase of products that are linked to companies such as JBS, as I just mentioned. We also need to call on our political leaders to stand up to the Jair Bolsonaro regime today and not do business under these conditions. So it's not just a consumer question. It's also a political question, increasingly.
Do you think that the global attention that's been captured by the Amazon fires is crystallizing this idea in more consumers' minds that there is a connection between the two?
Absolutely. I think that the fires today are really an alarm bell. This has been going on for many years. This is not the beginning of wholesale Amazon destruction, unfortunately. But the crisis we're witnessing today is a wake-up call to the world. And while I am distressed to see what is happening on the ground, particularly to indigenous communities who have been working hard to preserve their forests and are now experiencing over 3,500 fires on indigenous territories in the Amazon alone, to traditional peoples, to smallholders who are all suffering, we also see an opportunity here. We see an opportunity to make the powers that be them political or corporate, understand that their time is up, that this is no longer the way we want to do business, no longer the way we want to consume commodities linked to wholesale human rights abuses and forest destruction that are leading towards a crisis and emergency for all of humanity.
How much do you think these individual decisions matter? Whether, you know, say, for instance, you just choose to stop eating meat and that's all you do. I mean, is that a big enough individual decision to feel like you are contributing to the solution?
I think if enough people limit their meat consumption, we're on our way to doing something right. That's precisely what the IPCC report mentions, is that it's not about necessarily taking drastic steps to change our diets or drastic steps to change our lives, but to make like small incremental steps at a large scale. We all need to understand that we have a role together, not just as individuals. Therefore, the work here is not about one person deciding to limit their beef consumption or what have you. It's about people working together within their networks, getting informed, getting active, and understanding that there are ways to push back. There are ways to find solutions today.
Christian Poirier, director of Amazon Watch, a nonprofit that works to protect the rainforest and its indigenous people. Christian, thank you.
Thank you.
JBS did not give us a comment for this story, but has said in the past they do not acquire animals from farms involved with environmental crimes. In 2017, JBS signed a plea deal admitting to bribing politicians in one of Brazil's largest corruption scandals ever. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Susan Davis.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.